Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Yud Dalet Amud Aleph, 10 lines down. Amar Shmuel, my time of the Rabbanon. What is the reasoning behind the Rabbanon's position? Remember that in the Mishnah, and we also saw in the Braita, the Rabbanon believed that you may not return a shtar, whether it has a lien in it, whether it does not have a lien in it, you may not return the shtar. So Shmuel is asking, what's the reasoning behind the Rabbanon's position? So he says, Savre, Achrayut Taut Sofer Hu. They believe that the lack of a lien in the document is simply a mistake. It was an error on the part of the sofer. Others suggest that not only an error on the part of the sofer, it's even if the love and the malve, even if the debtor and creditor never mentioned it, the edim should still include it, or the sofer should still include it. It is a basic part of any document, especially a loan document, that there should be a lien that is placed on the property of the debtor. The question that Balei HaTosafot already asked over here is, how did Shmuel know that? How does Shmuel know that this is the position of the Rabbonon? Now, if he knows the Braita that we just mentioned yesterday, which would be helpful in directing us in that way or in that manner to understand the sheet of the Chachamim, then how did Shmuel have a position that was opposed to the Braita? Yesterday we said that the Braita was a Tiyufta de Shmuel. So if Shmuel knew the Braita, why is his position diametrically opposed to the Braita? If he doesn't know the Braita, then how does he know that this is the position of the Chachamim? So there are two approaches taken by the Rishonim. You can see the Balei HaTosafot say that he did not know the Braita. Nevertheless, logically, he understood it. He made heads or tails out of what the Rabbanan said and figured out that this makes the most sense as to why their position is such. Other Rishonim say no, that he knew the Braita or now he knows the Braita after they asked the question on him. And either he changed his mind, which is that he now believes that the Braita is correct, and therefore, now knowing the Braita, he has this information. Or, he said, despite the fact that he knew the Braita, he still felt that the Mishnah trumped the Braita, and therefore the Braita wasn't the way to explain the Mishnah, but rather it was in opposition to the Mishnah, and his position follows the Mishnah, not the Braita, but he knew about the Braita, and that's how you know that the Chachamim's position is, Achrayut Taot Sofer Hu. The lack of a lien in a loan document is a mistake. Amalei Rova bar Iti l'Ravidi ba'Avin, umi amar Shmuel hachi. Did Shmuel really say this? Va'amar Shmuel, shevach, shefer, v'shibud, tzarich li'malech. When a sofer is writing the document to document a transaction, he has to check as to the following matters. Shevach, shefer, and shibud. Shibud is the fact of whether there is a lien here in this situation. Or really, in this case, we're going to see in a second, it really means is there recourse for the transaction that's taking place. So that's number one. Shevach is the value that was added into the land, the increase in value that is generated from the individual who has it. And the shefer is the payment from what is the recourse done, meaning that in general, a bal chov, when it comes to a creditor, he is only allowed to collect from Beinonit, the middle-class property. So if you want to change that in the document or in the agreement between the parties, can you use Shefer, which is Idit, as Rashi says, the best property. So all of these items are not a given or not a default. The sofer has to check with the parties as to whether, first of all, there is recourse against the Shevach, not just recourse against the Keren, which is the principal amount that is placed in the document, but also the Shevach, the improvement that is done to the land, in the investment and the work that is done to the land, does he have recourse for that investment? The question of when he gets to have recourse, does he collect from only Beinonit or Idit? That has to be asked. The default is Beinonit. If he wants something of a higher class, it has to be written in, but it has to be something that is agreed upon. And Shibud, which is the fact that there is recourse, that needs to be checked with the sofer. The Meiri brings an alternative view of what Shefer is over here, to the difference between Shefer and Shevach, to the difference between Shevach Memela and Shevach of investment. So Shevach of investment is called Shevach. Shefer is just the natural value increase of the property, and that's what's being mentioned here in this statement of Shmuel. Not like the way Rashi explains it, that the Shefer is the quality of property by which he is allowing the person to claim against him or have recourse against him for. So now, lemer leman da marha, lo marha. Rashi says it'll be a machloket moraim in the name of Shmuel, as to whether Shmuel believes that a lien or recourse are a taut sofer, or they are not a taut sofer. Or you can say that Shmuel is giving the reasoning for the Rabbanon, but he doesn't hold like that reason. And therefore, there is a stira between the statements, but it's reconcilable. Lokash, Gemara says, no, we can reconcile this. Kan b'shtar halva'a. This is doing with a loan document. Deloya b'inish, zuzei b'chdei. People don't put their money out for free. People don't just throw their money around. Kan b'mekach chomengpar. Here is dealing with a transaction. Da'v'inish, d'zav'in ar le'yome. People buy land for a day. So now what the Gemara is describing is the difference in the nature of a transaction versus the nature of a loan. When it comes to a loan, and this is what we mentioned yesterday, Rashi is somewhat explaining this, which is that when you lend money without interest, there is no way to assess the risk involved in the loan. That means that when the borrower takes the money, if you were able to charge interest, you would change the interest depending on how risky the loan was and whether it was collateralized, whether there was a mortgage or a lien on the person's property. What is the security for the loan? The better the security, the less you would charge them. The lower the security, the more you would charge them. But over here, we know these are our interest-free loans. And interest-free loans, if you just give your money without taking any lien or security, you're basically throwing your money away. And that's why he believes that it's a taut sofer. Nobody would lend money when you have no way to offset the risk unless you got security that gave you good sense or protection that you're going to get the money back. Whereas by a transaction, a person might be willing to buy it knowing the risks that they could lose the property. The problem is that this person might have outstanding creditors who could come after the property and take it away from him. Now, if it's taken away from him, then you want to know, does he have recourse against the seller? So then, Shmuel says, Limalech, you have to check. That's not a given. A buyer might buy it understanding the risks that are involved. There, you can adjust the price for the risk. If the person has a high risk that this land might be taken or confiscated, foreclosed on, then when you buy it, you're going to buy it at a heavy discount, knowing or incorporating that risk. On the other hand, if there's a low probability of a foreclosure on the property, then you're going to pay more money for it. So people will buy property, quote unquote, for a day, as the Gemara says over here, meaning assuming the risk that they know that it could be foreclosed on the property. And that doesn't mean that they automatically, or we should automatically assume there is recourse against the seller because of the fact that it was foreclosed upon. Again, there you can adjust the price for the risk. That's something you can't do by the loan. It's a story of Avur Ba'idi, Zavin Alita Me'achte. He bought an aliyah. He bought a second floor, an upper floor of a house from his sister. Ata Balchov Tarfa Minei. The creditor of his sister came along and foreclosed on the property and took it away from him. Ata the Kami Demar Shmuel. He came before Shmuel to figure out what his options were at this point. Amalei Katva Lacha Achrayut. Did she write Achrayut, responsibility, recourse in the contract? When she sold it to you, did she say that there's recourse against her? Amalei Lo. He says, no, there was no recourse included in the document. Amalei Imkein Zil L'Shlalma. Go ahead. Lech L'Shalom. Basically, you're on your own. You can't get anything here. That's not a given that you have recourse. And if you didn't write the recourse into the document, you lost. You knew that there was a risk that it could be foreclosed upon, and you took that risk. And the fact that you didn't ask for recourse is now your problem, and you lost out. That's it. Samalei. So Abu Abari says back to Shmuel, Ba'amar hu d'amar achriyot tut soferhu. Aren't you the one who says that the lack of a lien in the document is a mistake? Amalei, he answers back, Shmuel, the same that we answered on behalf of Shmuel, which is, Hanei milei b'shtar halva'ah. That's only in cases when we're dealing with a loan document. Abo b'shtar mekach memkar, lo. But when it comes to transactions, that's not the case. So here we see from Shmuel that there is a distinction between mekach memkar, a transaction, versus a loan. Over here it's a transaction. And in a transaction, you don't automatically get recourse. You have to ask for it. You have to demand the recourse. Otherwise, we assume you've adjusted the price to account for the risk of confiscation or foreclosure. It's interesting here, the Gemara conflates between the ability to have recourse and a lien. The Gemara sees them as being identical in just different contexts. In that the ability to have a lien is the right to go and take back when you lose out. And the same thing with recourse is a way to have an ability to claim when you lose out. So in both cases, the Gemara views them similarly, most likely because in both cases, a person is giving money and then not getting the money back. In the case of a loan, he lent to the debtor. The debtor can't repay it now, so he needs to go foreclose and get property. In the case of the transaction, the person purchased the land. But so he basically gave him money, but now the land's gone because it was claimed by someone else. So now he's trying to get his money back, and also he wants a ability to have recourse or get some sort of land or way to access recourse or to be repaid for the money that he put out. So they do have similarities, even though the words that we use, and technically they are different concepts, the Gemara here sees them as one, nevertheless makes a distinction, which is that shtarei hova'a, which Shmuel says is a ta'ut sofer, it's a mistake if it doesn't have a lien in it. Again, we discussed because of the fact that there's no risk adjustment mechanism because you don't charge interest. Whereas by mekach u'memkar, where there is a risk adjustment mechanism, which is the price that you pay, over there it's not automatic that you have recourse. It has to be stated explicitly. Because David Inish does aminar eliyome, because people purchase property for a day, or I mean, understanding the risks that they're undertaking when they buy the property, that someone could come and foreclose on the property and they could lose it any minute. Amar Abaye, Ruvain shemachar sadeh l'Shimon. Ruvain who sold the field to Shimon, ba'achrayut, with recourse. Uba bal chov deru Ruvain, and the creditor of Ruvain comes, v'katarif le'minei, and comes to foreclose on the property and take it away from Shimon. Dinahu da'azel Ruvain umishtai dina ba'adei. Ruvain has a right to get into the fray and adjudicate the case with the creditor. V'lo matzui amarle, the creditor can't say to Ruvain, lav bal dvarim didi at. You're not a relevant party to the case. This isn't within your jurisdiction to deal with me. Because, amarle, mafkat mine, ala didi hadar. In the end, whatever you take away from Shimon, he's coming back to me to get it, because there's recourse. So there is a somewhat of a transitive property over here that makes it see-through, which is that the creditor is just needs the property because he's foreclosing. The property now sits in the hands of Shimon. The creditor can't say to Ruvain, who's the original debtor, what are you bothered with? I'm going after land from Shimon. What's your issue here? You deal with Shimon. I'm going to deal with Shimon, but you don't deal with me. The answer is no, because we look at it as almost if it's see-through, akin to Shibuda the Rabbi Notan, but this idea that once the creditor goes after Shimon, Shimon's going back to Ruvain. So in the end, the creditor, in essence, is going after Ruvain, which is the original relationship of the creditor to the debtor. And therefore, the Ruvain can enter into the fray, can be a party to the case. The Tosafot already here asks, what's the difference? Why does it matter that Ruvain is a party to the case? Even the claims that Shimon can't make, but Ruvain can make, Beit Din will make on behalf of Shimon. Shimon, who is now a party that's losing out because of a creditor coming after his property, in those cases, Beit Din steps up and makes claims that Ruvain could have otherwise made. So Ruvain being in the case isn't necessarily beneficial. In addition, Tosafot points out that if it has to do with Krovim, say certain people are relatives to Shimon but not relatives to Ruvain, or vice versa, Tosafot says it makes no difference. They are nogeya badavar, they can't testify in the case. If you are a Karov to either Ruvain or Shimon, you're pasul and edut in this case, because you are a nogeya badavar to a party to the case, irrespective of which party. So that's not going to help. That's not a difference between Ruvain and Shimon. So what exactly is the reason that Ruvain should be able to enter the fray, or what he's going to add to the case over here by coming in? So Tosfo brings a number of meivins. He says, Ishlamar, a case where Shimon says, I have no edim, and I have no proof. He says, Beit Din, and makes a declaration that I have nothing to offer in the case. I'm closing my case out, basically. I have no more evidence. And then, and all of a sudden now, he finds evidence, or he finds edim. But since he already told the Beit Din that he has no more information that he can bring, he's precluded from bringing the information. Shenu yachol avi. The halacha is not like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel in Raya Achrona. We quote this around Shas. That the halacha is like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel in the Mishnah, except for three cases. One of those cases is Raya Achrona, where Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel lets you, even after you say, I brought my last proof, he still lets you bring additional proofs. But the halacha is not like Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel there. And once you've said you've closed your arguments, you are done. So now what can happen is Ruvain can bring them. Because Shimon's the one who closed out the case, but Ruvain never closed out his options. And so therefore, Ruvain can now bring the evidence on behalf of Shimon. So that's a nafkamina. Inami, kagon shabachov, chayav shvuah d'oraita l'Ruvain. in a case where the Baal Chov has another Shvua D'Oraita to Ruvain, and he can do a Gilgul Shvua. Meaning that for whatever other reason he has an altercation with Ruvain, if Ruvain's a party to this case, in that situation he can be Megalgel the Shvua and say, listen, once you're doing a Shvua about this, I want to know about the loan as well. So that's another benefit Ruvain would have over Shimon. And even though technically Shimon could generate a Shvua D'Rabbanon, nevertheless, we know from the Gemara in Ketubot, the Gemara in Shavuot, that there are differences between a Shvua D'Oraita and a Shvua D'Rabbanan, that a Shvua D'Oraita is much more chamur, plus you have additional aspects of a Shvua D'Oraita in cases where it gets flipped, where one person can't take it. There are other nafkaminot between them, and therefore there's a value to Reuven entering the case or the fray here. The other thing you could argue is that Reuven just feels like he's a better advocate than Shimon. Said Shimon's a weak party in the case. He's not going to argue the case well. He's not going to bring enough evidence. If I enter into the case, I think I have a much more solid arguments, or I'll bring more proofs. I'll be more aggressive about this. So you could just argue from that perspective that Ruvain has an advantage over Shimon, or that maybe he is a good lawyer, we'll call it, that he has unusual or very convincing arguments that he could bring that others might not think of, or that Beit Din can't utilize and won't make on behalf of Shimon. So those are the reasons that it's important that Ruvain can enter the fray here and be a party to the confiscation and foreclosure, because he has what Tosfot says over these advantages to the others that we added over Shimon. Now, Ikid Amrei, some say, Afilu Shlo Barachrayut Nami. Even if there is no recourse against Ruvain, that means when the creditor takes or forecloses the property from Shimon, Shimon has no recourse against Ruvain, so Ruvain's not really a party to the case in that situation. There's no see-through confiscation, because Ruvain has no monetary interest in the case anymore. He's not going to be called upon to make whole Shimon, because he sold it to Shimon without recourse. Nevertheless, he still is considered to be a party to the case according to this Ikud Amrei. Damarlei lo nechali davi Shimon tarom et alai. I don't want Shimon to have a complaint against me. Meaning that there are two reasons to be a party to the case. One is a monetary loss. That's the first situation that we said over here, where he has recourse against Ruvain. There's a monetary reason for him to be in the fray or to enter into the case, because he doesn't want to lose money. There's a second issue here, which is reputational risk. He says, listen, if you foreclose on the property from Shimon, he's not going to be happy. I'm going to have a hard time selling properties in the future or to interacting with Shimon in the future. So I have reputational risk here, and therefore I'm a party to this, because you're affecting my standing here. So even though it's not a tangible monetary loss, there is intangible items here that make me a party to the case. And according to the Ikud Amrei, that's enough to allow Ruvain to be a party to the case, to defend his reputation or to protect Shimon, because otherwise Shimon's going to have complaints against him. Vamar Abaye, now we have another statement of Abaye. You might remember these Gemarot we saw in Ketubot together and Baba Kama together. Over here, Abaye makes another statement, which turns out to be a major machlok between Rashi and Tosafot, Ketubot, and in Baba Kama. And over here, Tosafot once again makes his points as to why he thinks Rashi is wrong. Ruvain sold property to Shimon without recourse. And then they have these claimants that are coming. Rashi over here says, Orerim, people who are questioning the authority of this individual to sell it, questioning his title to the property, meaning that there is serious questions about this individual's right to sell it or whether he even owns the property. Rashi in other places mentions anasim, that they were actually strong men that were coming to steal the property. Tosafot does not like that so much. He thinks that asikim here are more along the lines of orerim, and Rashi himself over here says that they were orerim, people who are questioning the title or saying that the land belongs to them. Rightfully, legally, not people are coming and just strong-arming the land away. Or Ruvain sold property to Shimon that he didn't really own, or that there was a previous lien on. They have a real legal claim that they're bringing here. So now, Achelo Yechzikba, before he takes possession of it, Yechol Lachzorbo, Shimon come back out. So if the questions start to arise, or the rumors start to circulate before he takes possession of the land, he can back out of it. Mechesh Yechzikba, and Yechol Lachzor. In a case when he's already taken possession of the land, then he can't back out of it. Now, that seems obvious. I mean, that the difference between whether the sale is complete or not complete has to do with whether he took possession of the land. Rashi says over here, in order to make the case palatable in the Gemara, is Shvelo Natan Maot, when he didn't pay money. Because money is a mechanism of acquisition by land, by real estate. The Gemara in Kedushin tells us there are three ways to acquire land, which is kesef, shtar, and chazakah. So he already paid the money, the transaction would have been done, and he can't back out of it. So what Rashi says is that they're using chazakah as the mechanism of acquisition. Until he makes a chazakah, or until he exercises a chazakah on the property, he can back out of the deal. Damalei, but once he makes a chazakah, once he does something that acquires it on his behalf, then he can't back out of it. Damalei, chayta de katre savart vikabalt. That you basically bought a sack full of knots or full of strings. Means that it's a sack that has lots of rope or lots of knots around it. Looks like there's a big package inside. And then you open it up and there's nothing in there. So the same thing over here. You knew what was the situation here. You bought it. You deal with it. You bought something. You knew exactly what was here. There was all full disclosure up front. And these issues that came up, yeah, they came up after the fact, but that's what you bought. You should have done more due diligence before the fact. Now that you bought it, you're stuck with it. Now Rashi in other places says that it's like basically a sack of air, which would be the expression that we would use today. You bought a sack of hot air or emptiness. You bought what you got, and that's it. You're stuck with it now. Meimetai havi a chazaka. When did you have a chazaka? Mechidayish ametzre. When he walks the borders. Ikadami, afilu b'achrayut nami. Even if he sold it with recourse, he can't back out of the transaction. When the people who think that I don't have title to land, foreclose on the land, or come and confiscate it from you, you'll go to Beit Din. Beit Din will write you a document that says that the land was confiscated. You'll come to me, and then I'll pay you. That's when you have your recourse. Until then, I don't believe they have a real case, so I don't really worry about it. You want to deal, you deal with them till then. Once you're done with them and it's been confiscated, we'll talk. But until that point in time, I don't want to deal with you. Now, what you see from this part of the Gemara, first of all, is that when Shimon has recourse against Reuven, Reuven has the option to enter into the case. He is not obligated to enter into the case. He can say to Shimon, look, when they come and take it away from you, come back to me and I'll pay you. You're right. You have a right to get the claim here. But until it happens, don't bother me about it. So there we see that he's not obligated to enter the fray. He only has the option. If he wants to go in there to prevent the problem from happening, then he can enter the fray. But if he decides to step back and say, let whatever happens, happens, but you'll come to me when you're done, fine, that's also a fine option. The problem with Rashi's pshat over here, and that's what Tosfot raises, is what is the question? What's being said here is so simple. If the kinyan on the land is chazakah, then of course, before chazakah you can back out. After chazakah, you can't back out. Meaning that, what is even the Gemara adding? Number two problem is, the Gemara asks over here, what's a chazakah? What do you mean, what's a chazakah? It's an explicit Mishnah in Baba Batra of what a chazakah is. Now, gadar uparatz. Right? Whether you put up a fence, he broke a fence down, he locked the door, he did something to exercise ownership over the land. It's very clear what a chazakah is. Why does the Gemara need a new definition of chazakah, which doesn't exist in Baba Batra? Plus, why does it even need to ask the question? For all those reasons, Tosafot has a very hard time with Rashi's Pshat here, and the other times in Shas where it's mentioned, is because it doesn't seem to make any sense. The Gemara seems to be talking about issues that are so obvious, and information that's well known in Mishnayot. Both of those are Mishnayot. Mishnah in Kiddushin says, Kesef Shtar and Chazakah are a Kinyan. Mishnah in Baba Batra tells you what a Chazakah is. Now, Gadar Uparatz. What do I need a Gemara here to discuss this? Therefore, Tosafot already says, Tema, Heichi Mari. What exactly is the situation here? Im gam lo natan manot, if he didn't pay money, pshita, that he can back out of it until the chazakah is exercised, because there's not even a mishapara, there's not even a lack of faith or good faith there when he backs out of it. It was just a handshake. There was nothing done to finalize the transaction. There was no money, there was no chazakah, nothing. Of course he can back out of it. If he already gave ma'ot, if he already paid money, then why do you need the chazakah? Money is a sufficient means to be which to acquire. Once you've given the money, what do you need the chazakah for? And if you say it's in a city where they don't accept money as the completion of the transaction, you need a chazakah, then, of course, you're back to square one, which is very simple. Then if in a place where money doesn't work, then chazakah works. So again, before the chazakah he can back out, after the chazakah he can't back out. All this information is clear and obvious. You don't need a baye to tell you this information. And so therefore, Tosafot concludes over here, Perish Riva, Demayri Kagon Shukana, Bekinyan Gamur, Kagon Chalipin, Elonatan Maot. He used a Kinyan Chalipin, which is interesting, whether Kinyan Chalipin works by real estate. Tosfot over here, based on the Riva, is saying that it does work. In other places, he says otherwise. But here you have a kinyan chalipin. He's using a representative kinyan in order to acquire the property. So he's not using money. He's using another form of kinyan that's not mentioned of keshev, star, and chazaka, but rather chalipin. V'kamar. Achlo yechzikba chazaka, the mefarish. Until he takes that chazaka, the one that we're about to explain, which is he walks the property. Lo samcha date. He does not have gemira to dat, and he can back out. Basically, kinyan chalipin is a representative kinyan. It's not a real kinyan. Kesef, shtar, and chazaka are real forms of kinyan, because it's about the land itself that you're buying, the real estate you're buying, and you're doing something that is a purchase of the land, whether it's documented, whether it's through money, whether it's through actually doing something physically to the land. Then when you do a kinyan chalipin is a representative kinyan, which is buyer hands the handkerchief to the seller, and the seller's kinyan on the handkerchief will then cause the property to move possession. But the transfer is only representative, because the sudar, the handkerchief, is just a representative form of kinyan. It's not, you actually return the handkerchief after the kinyan. You don't get to keep it necessarily. I mean, we'll see that in the Gemara Baba Batra. Gemara discusses whether you do or you don't keep it, but the fact is it's a representative kinyan. In order to have gemira tadat, which is what kinyanim are all about, what we want with the kinyan is that's a finalization. The person has in his mind no more reservations about this transaction, and now he's been willing to enter into the transaction in an irreversible way. So that's what gemira tadat is, that you've come to a conclusive decision that you're going to buy the property. So when you do these other forms of kinyan, that's an indication of gemira tadat. By kinyan chalipin, which is a representative kinyan, generally we say that's what generates the gemira tadat. But by real estate, what the Gemara is suggesting, or Rabbi is suggesting over here, is that real estate requires another level of gemira tadat, which is that it's not just like buying metalkalin, where you're buying a cow or a camel, and you use a kinyan chalipin, and it works right away, and that's the gemira tadat. When you're buying real estate, the gemira tadat involves interacting with the property, and you have to walk the borders. And walking the borders is what really finalizes the kinyan chalipin, or gives you the full gemira tadat, where you can't walk away from the kinyan. Without that, the kinyan chalipin, which is a representative kinyan, is not necessarily strong enough to bind him to the transaction because of the fact that it is a representative kinyan and not a full-fledged kinyan. And again, the standard of real estate is higher than the standard of metalkalin. And for that reason, we are talking about a case, again, no money, kinyan chalipin, and the chazaka we're not talking about here is not your classic chazaka of the Mishnah Kedushin and Mishnah Bava Batra, but a chazaka to demonstrate the seriousness of your kinyan chalipin. So that's the way that Tosafot explains this Gemara, in order to avoid all the questions that he posed against the Rashi. And now the Gemara continues and says, Yitmar, Mocher sadeh chaveiro, v'nimtzait she'eino shelo. Person sells a property to his friend, won't be his friend anymore, but he sold it, but he doesn't own the property. He doesn't have title to the property. He sold him property that he doesn't own. He's basically a thief. He is a gazlan. He stole someone's property and now is selling it to a third party. Rav Amar, yesh lo ma'ot, v'yesh lo shevach. The individual here who had the property sold to them, mistakenly, meaning that the person who sold them didn't have title and now they bought it, they have recourse against that gazlan, both for the ma'ot, the monies, and the shevach, and the improvement in the land. Imze, Rashi says, hishbiach et hakarka. Here we're speaking about someone who invested in the property and raised the value of the land. So he has a claim against the gazlan for both items. Shmuel ma'ot yeshlo, shevach einlo. He has a claim for the monies that he laid out for the land. In terms of the shevach, he does not have a right to go after the gazlan. Rashi asks over here, with regards to the position of Rav, which says that yeshlo shevach, you do have a right of claim for the shevach, the improvement in the land. So what's the scenario here? Vim tomar, hanigzal yitein shevach, sheyeshivo karka mishubechet. It seems like the person whose land was stolen should be the one paying for the improvement. The one whose land was stolen now goes and grabs the land away from the buyer. And again, an innocent buyer who bought the land thinking that the other person had title to it, improved the land. Now the nigzal comes and says, that's my land. And he takes the land back. But he's getting land back that's worth more than the land that was stolen from him. So shouldn't the nigzal have to compensate the buyer of the property for the improvements he did to the land? Why are we saying over here that he needs to go after the gazlan for the shevach? He should go after the nigzal for the shevach. So Rashi says it's a situation or a scenario where they stole the property when it was at a higher level of value, or it was improved already. Then the Gazlan himself let it go to waste, or basically caused the property to lose value. He did not properly care for the property. So now the property diminished in value. The buyer now improves the property, returns it to its former state. So as far as the Nigzal is concerned, when he goes and takes the property away from the buyer, he's getting back what he lost. The property is not more improved than when he lost it. That's exactly what the property looked like when he had stolen from him. So in that scenario, he takes the property back and he has to have to compensate. But as far as the buyer is concerned, he can go after the Gazlan because he improved the property from the value that he bought it from the Gazlan for. So that's what Rashi answers, explains what the Shevach is in our scenario over here. Tosfot points out, and Rashi does this a number of times afterwards, and he says, "Shanigzal lokeach hakarka meshevach, venu mishalem lokeach rachat yitzia." Rashi notes this many times, and we saw this back in the Gemara in Baba Kama, which is that the Nigzal, when he confiscates the property away, and the property is now more improved than when he lost it, he has to give the buyer at least the costs. It's really the lower of cost or benefit of the investment made in the property, because he's getting something that he didn't own before. So he has to repay for that, or he has to give money for that. He gives him the money or the value of the lower of the cost or benefit that was generated over here. So then, according to Tosfos, the question of Rashi really revolves around the excess amount. The difference between his investment and the improvement value in the property. Why doesn't the Nigzal have to pay for it? So here, the claim is that the Nigzal already had that property at that level before, and therefore the investment and improvement in the property all came from the value of the lack of care placed by the Gazlan to the buyer. The question here is, do you have recourse for the Shevach? Or do you not have recourse for the Shevach? That's a machloket Rav and Shmuel over here. Baumine mi Ravuna. Perash lo et haShevach mahu. What is the story if they actually articulated in their transaction that the Gazlan would be responsible for the Shevach? Again, we have a property that belonged to some party. Reuven came and squatted on the land or claimed that the land was his, sold it to someone else, even though he didn't own it. And then their transaction, Reuven made a lot of promises. He said, I'm selling you this land with recourse and including recourse for Shevach. So now when it's explicit, what do we say? Does Shmuel there agree to Rav? Mau, time of the Shmuel Mishum to lo perish, Shivcha. The reason that you don't get to collect the Shevach is because you did not articulate it. You did not put it in the transaction. Bacha perishla. Over here you did put it in the transaction and therefore you do have a rightful claim. Odilma, time of the Shmuel came into Letle Karka, Mechse Karibit. Problem here is that since there is no land here, it starts to look like an interest payment. What's interesting is that the Nigzal came and confiscated the land. So meantime, his money, the buyer's money, is sitting with the Gazlan. So now, the land is gone, and the Gazlan has the money. So what it turns out to be, in essence, is a loan to the Gazlan. Because he gave him money, and now the Gazlan's got to return the money. The return of that money is basically a quote-unquote a return of the loan. He lent the money, and now he's getting it back. That wasn't his intent when he bought the property, but now that's what the end game is that the property's been taken away, the money's with the Gazlan, he needs to get the money back. It's as if he lent the money to the Gazlan. Now, if the Gazlan was to return more money than he paid him, that would look like rebate. It would look like interest. It's clearly not interest. It's clearly compensation for the Shevach that's there, but in an optical sense, you gave him money, now you're getting back more money than you gave him. It looks like interest. Now, it's a very difficult position to take as well, because it's clear here that you have an innocent buyer who's losing out because it mechse karibit, and he's the one being penalized. But maybe that's the case. Amalei in velav. The way Rashi says that he first said yes, then he said no. V'rafi yabiyade, and he was uncertain about it. He vacillated on the answer. That's the way I would have explained it. In Balav, not necessarily in that order, but just he was sometimes yes, sometimes no, and he was just vacillating. He didn't have the answer clearly about what Shmuel's position was. Itmar, Amar Rav Nachman Amar Shmuel. So now we have Rav Nachman quoting Shmuel. Ma'ot yeshlo, shevach einlo. He gets the principal amount back, not the shevach. Afo pishi perishlo at the shevach. Here you have it explicit, even if he states, or even if the document states that there is recourse for the shevach, doesn't matter. My taima came into karka enlo, skarma utav, omeid vinotel. Since the galon has been confiscated from the transaction now, all that's left is the monetary part of the transaction. That looks like a loan, and it's mechzeh kiribit. Eitvei Rova the Rav Nachman. So now Rova challenges Rav Nachman's statement here in the name of Shmuel. Ein motzim lachilat peirot, ulesheva karkaot, ulemazona yishava abanot, mnechasim mishubanim ibnei tikkun olam. Here is an institution, a takana v'chachamim, which is to facilitate the ability for people to buy properties and keep the market liquid in the ability of people to exchange properties or to buy and sell properties. The reason being is that people in general have outstanding claims against them. There's almost nobody who doesn't have an outstanding claim. At minimum, they are married and they have a ketubah, which is a claim against them. Within the ketubah, there are many promises that the husband makes, including the fact that if he passes away, his wife can stay in the estate and she can eat from the estate for as long as she wants and she doesn't collect her ketubah. The fact that he has to support his daughters out of the estate or the monies that are left behind. So those are the mazone yishava banot. And so you see, what the chachamim did was say, if we allow people to go and collect from encumbered property these items, nobody's going to buy the property because it's an unassessable risk. There's certain risks where I can assess them and then I can adjust the price for the risk. In a situation where you cannot size or quantify the risk, it's very hard to assign a price. People will be very reluctant to buy that property, or they're going to severely discount the price they're willing to pay. Here you're dealing with the possibility that the widow will stay in the estate and eat from the estate. And since that's a tnai ha-ketubah, she will, through the ketubah, have a lien to go and collect from encumbered property. That means that when a person buys the property, he has no idea what exposure he has. Ketubah, I know what the size of the ketubah is. I know exactly what the risk is. But here, mazon isha or mazon abanot, these are items that can go on endlessly. These are items that could be much bigger or much smaller than he thought. Therefore, people will not necessarily be able to assess the risk, and it will shut down liquidity in the market. So that's why the chachamim, in that case, mazon isha and abanot, shut it down. Sheva karkot is the same problem. It's one thing if a person has sold property already or lent money already. We know what has happened. We know the price that was paid. We know what was done. In that case, I can assess the risk of foreclosure or loss when I buy the property from him. But if you also, as a person who bought property from him previous to me, get your not only your keren back, your principal back, but any investment you made in the property, I can't assess that. I don't know how much money people are going to put into this property. And they can put in more and more money even after I bought the property. And then even after I paid for it, that risk goes up and up and up. It's an unquantifiable risk. And that's the reason Chachamim said no collecting from encumbered property with these items. Because otherwise, either nobody's going to buy property or they're going to pay very little for property because of the fact that it's too risky. There's too big a liability that might exist over here, this unquantified liability. So now the question is, it says over here that as far as the Shevach is concerned, you're not allowed to collect those from encumbered property. But from free and clear property, you do have a right to collect it. That's a question on Shmuel. Shmuel says you don't have a right to Shevach. The property is stolen and then sold to this individual who invests in the property. He can get his principal back. He cannot get his Shevach back. Over here, the Mishnah says you can't collect from encumbered property for Shevach. But you do have a right to collect from free and clear property, which means that you do have a right to collect Shevach. Viktani mia the Shevach Karkot. And in the list of items here is Shevach Karkot. My love, what's the scenario in the Mishnah? Because keach mi gazlan, where he purchased it from a thief. Oh, Mar says, no, who says that's the scenario here? Maybe it is Bebal Chov. It's a creditor. The creditor is coming to collect. And when the creditor comes to collect, he has a right of collection with regards to certain items, not others. So the assumption here is that we're talking about the Shevach piece of this, and that the people who bought the property from the debtor improved the property. So when the creditor comes to collect the property or take a lien on the property and exercises foreclosure rights, he can foreclose on the principal as well as the Shevach. That would be the assumption here. And he would have to compensate for the Shevach. He can't just take the Shevach. But he would pay the lower of, again, the cost or the benefit that was added to the field. But that gives him additional collateral that didn't exist when he extended the loan. And as Rashi explains over here with the Baal Chov, in that case, it is what we call a mechira. Because had the debtor paid cash to the creditor would not have a right to come and collect the property. So now that the creditor goes after the property, it is not the equivalent of a loan. Remember in the case of the gazlan, when he confiscates the property, we say, well, now it's as if he lent money to the gazlan. And the gazlan pays it back to Shevach, it looks like he's paying interest for it. The answer is no. That over here, what ended up happening is that the creditor comes, the debtor could have paid him cash. When the debtor does not pay him cash and then confiscates the property, it's the equivalent of a new purchase of the property. And therefore, Hilka Kimishalim in the Yoter Mashikibel Ashtahu, the other Zovin Mine Karka Mechuralov, the Mexic Skarmautav. Therefore, when the debtor has to pay back the buyers for their losses, he has to pay them both the principal and the Shevach and the benefit over here. The reason being is because it doesn't look like the case of Gazlan, where it looks like you're paying him back more money than he gave to you, because over here, the nature of the movement of the karka is not obvious. The land is not automatically going to the creditor. In the case of the Gazlan's case, the land is automatically going to the Nigzal because it belongs to him. So there's no question here that the land is out of the picture, and the only thing is you have two monetary transactions, one where he gave him money, money's getting money back, and he's getting more money back than he gave. It looks like interest. Over here, by the case of a buyer, he bought the land, gave the debtor money. Then the creditor comes to foreclose on the property. If the debtor sticks cash in front of the creditor, he has no right to come and take and foreclose on the property. For that reason, now, when he comes and takes the property, it's the equivalent of a new sale. It's the equivalent of him selling it back to the creditor. If that's the case, it's not mechse karibit. It looks like they have two transactions, a case where he bought the land, and a case where the debtor is buying the land back from him because it was confiscated by the creditor. And now the land is worth more. So he has to pay more for it to buy it back. It does not look like ribit. It looks like two different transactions. So in that case, it won't be mechse karibit. And Shmuel will agree that the debtor will have to pay for the shevach in that case, at least from free and clear property. He'll have to compensate the buyer, not only for the keren, but also for the shevach that he lost in this scenario. The way Rashi explains this whole Gemara here, we're talking about shevach of investment, when the buyer improved the land and invested in the land. Shevach mameila, if it appreciated by itself, then you have less reason to have recourse against the individual because you didn't do anything. In the case of an exile, you say, my land improved. You didn't do anything. It happened by itself. I don't have to pay you anything. That's number one. In the case of the debtor, you can say the same thing. Listen, the land improved. You didn't add anything. You're not at a loss. You're getting your money back. Why do you need the shevach? You know, why are you entitled to the appreciation? You didn't do anything. So there, it would be less obvious why he would have a right to make a claim of shevach. So now, the Gemara says, wait a minute. That explanation of the Mishnah is interesting, but Iba Bachov, if you're talking about Bachov, Emaresha, what are you going to do with the first line in the Mishnah? Emotzin Achilat Peirot. What exactly is Achilat Peirot? Iba Bachov, Bachov Mi'it Le Peirei? Since when does a creditor have a right to the Peirot? Barmer Shmuel, Bachov Govet Shevach. He's allowed to take the Shevach, Shevachin, of a Peirot Lo. The right of a Baal Chov when he forecloses on the property is to take the property with the improvements in it. And once again, Rashi notes here that he'll have to pay the lower of the cost or benefit of that improvement, but he will get to confiscate it along with the property itself. Now then, Peirot, Rashi describes over here, Peirot being Peirot Gmurim, fully mature, ripened fruits that are on the property, or meaning basically produce that no longer needs the land. He does not have a right of foreclosure on that. He can foreclose on the land, but not the items that are on the land. So you can't explain the Mishnah in that case as a Baal Chov. Elapshita begozel v'nigzal. The only way to explain about Peirot in that case is when you're talking about a thief and an exal. The exal is entitled to his Peirot. It's his land that produced the fruits, and he's going to confiscate it and take the Peirot with it. He says, my land created the Peirot. Again, he will have to pay the buyer from the gazlan. He will have to pay him the lower of the cost or benefit of what was invested in the land. But he'll say the additional value above the investment was my land that did it. You didn't do it. It was my land. And I'm entitled to that. So over there by Peirot, you can understand why the buyer has a claim for Peirot, because an exal is going to confiscate it. But in the case of a creditor cannot foreclose on the Peirot. So what claim does the buyer have against the debtor? Umadureisha begozel v'nigzal, seifanami begozel v'nigzal. The first line in the Mishnah is talking about theft. Then the next line in the Mishnah about Shevach should also be talking about theft. And again, it'll be a problem with Shmuel. Gemara says, Midaria. Who says that? Hadagita, Hadagita. Each case is independent in the Mishnah. When it says Achilat Peirot, when's the case of Peirot? That's Gazlan and Nigzal. case of Shevach, that's the case of Bar Chov. So you can, through the Mishnah, we'll change what the nature of the case is, even though they all have the same din, quote unquote. That's why they're put together, which is you don't have a right to claim them from encumbered property. Nevertheless, each scenario is independent. Va'alotani ochi. Wait a minute. Don't we have a braita that qualifies that Mishnah in Gitin? And that braita says the following. The Sheva Karkaot Ketzad. What is the scenario of Sheva Karkaot? Hare, Shigazal Sade Mechaveiro. He stole something from his friend, a field. Varei Yotsami Tachan Yado. And now he still has it. The Beit Din is confiscating it from the Gazlan. When he claims the principal amount, he can go after encumbered property. And the improvements, he can only go after free and clear property. It says, Echidami, what is the scenario in this Braita? If you want to say it like it's written exactly, Gazlan Miman Gove. Who does he have recourse against? He stole the property. So now when the Nigzal comes and rightfully takes his property back, what type of claim does the Gazlan over here? Oh, pay me for the property. What do you mean pay him for the property? He stole the property. He has no claim over here. El Alav, what must be the scenario in the Braita? The scenario that we brought before, a case where he steals a field from his friend, and then sold it to a third party. And the third party improved it. So now the third party has the property confiscated from him because it belongs to the Nigzal, from the original owner. And buyer wants to have recourse against the Gazlan. He has recourse for both the principal amount and the Shevach. Again, that'll be a question on Shmuel. And also shows that the Mishnah Gittin is explaining the case of Shevach as a case of Gazlan and Nigzal. Amalei, lav terutzei kametaritzt? Wait a minute, the braita that you brought was unreadable, inexplicable. Meaning that you already said to us that the braita you couldn't explain, so what did you do? You amended the braita to fix the case. So, taritz nami b'bal chov. If you want to answer the case to be like you, then answer the case to be like me. Make it a case of bal chov in the braita. Just like you can switch the case to make it fit, and make it fit logically, you can do the same for me and call it a bal chov. Now, truthfully, making it into a bal chov is a much bigger jump than saying that it's a case of Gazlan who sells it to a third party, because at least the word Gazlan is mentioned in that Braita. So that would be a more logical extension or explanation of the Braita. Nevertheless, if you're already amending the Braita, amend it in my favor, and I don't see that as a question. Tashma. Again, Achilat Peirot, Ketzad. The case of Achilat Peirot in the Mishnah in Gitin. What's that case? Harish Gazal Sadeh Michaviro. Again, he stole from his friend. Farihi Yotsami Tachat Yado, Beit Din is confiscating it from him. He can collect the principal amount out of encumbered property. And Perot, you can only collect out of free and clear property. Hey Chidami, once again, what's the case here in the Braita? If you take it literally, Gazlan Miman Gove. The Gazlan has no recourse against anybody. So what does it mean? He goes to collect this from this and this from this. He doesn't have any right of collection. He's a thief. Isn't the scenario here again a case where he stole it from his friend, then sold it to a third party, and the third party improved the property? And what do you see? That he's entitled to get that shevach, those peyrot from the field. Amarova, no, you don't have to say that. Now, there's a question in the Girsa whether that belongs. The Gra brings that the Rambam says that that seems to think that the Girsa does not include Mlei Aperot. But he stole the property when it was already laden. The fruits were mature on the property. V'chalatei Peirot. And he ate those Peirot. Meaning the Gazlan ate the Peirot. V'chafer bar borot shichinu me'arot. And then he ruined the property. He dug up the property. He left a mess on the property. He did damage to the real estate itself. Banigzal legavot. Now the person who really owned the property comes to make a claim against the Gazlan and wants to collect against the Gazlan. Karen, the principal amount, govem nechasim mishubadim, he can go after him even from encumbered property for the principal amount of the property that he stole. Over here, you can't just say, arei shalcha lefanecha. By land, we said, karka en enigzelet. Land can't be stolen. So the thief could just say to the owner, arei shalcha lefanecha, your land's back. What do you need? Why do you have no claim against me? The answer here is that he did physical damage to the property. In doing so, he was able to steal, quote-unquote, property. Stealing by doing damage, he reduced the value actively of the land. And in doing so, he has to compensate the nigzal for that loss. That loss can come out of encumbered property. Ba nigzal legavot peirot. And then if the nigzal wants to come and claim the fruits that were on the property that the Gazlan ate, He only has a right to go after free and clear property in that case. So if he ruins the property, that damage or that loss, the Nigzal can go after the Gazlan for, even from the Gazlan's encumbered property. I mean, if he sold property to other people, he can go after that. On the other hand, when it comes to the peirot on the property, which are metalkalin or more like metalkalin, over there his recourse is only to go after the free and clear property of the Gazlan, not to go after buyers who bought property before. That encumbered property has no right to go after. But Rova's answer then protects Shmuel's position, because it says you can explain the Mishnah and Gittin based on the qualification of the Braita, that yes, we're talking about a case of a Gazlan. And I can explain within the case of Gazlan that this is the scenario, not what Rova had proposed before, which is the possibility that we're talking about a Gazlan who then sold it to a third party, which would be supportive of Rav's position that you do get a claim on Shevach, or against Shmuel's position that says that you have no claim on Shevach. Where it says, Rabba Baruch Amar, Kagon Shnatlua Misikin. It's a case where Misikin, Rashi says over here, are Anasim Akum. These are strong men who come and steal property. Natlua mina Gazlan. They stole it away from the Gazlan. Umachmato. And the reason they stole it was because he was on the property. They were after him in particular, and they wanted his land. So the Gazlan is the proximate cause for the loss of the land over here. It's not like you can say, Arei Shalchala Fenecha, and he says, look, these guys were coming to take property anyway. It doesn't matter that I was there or you were there. Wouldn't matter, they took it. Here it's clear, as Rashi says, it was his fault that the land was taken. He had some altercation with them. He had some previous issues with them. And they came and confiscated the property as if it is his. So that's why the Nigzal lost out. It's the Gazlan's fault. So Baga Nigzal Legavot Karen, when he goes after the principal amount that he wants to claim against the Gazlan, he has a right to go after encumbered property from people who bought property from this Gazlan after he had already stolen the first property. Banigzal Legavot Peirot, if he wants to get his claim for the Peirot around the property from the Gazlan, then Govem Nechasim B'nei Chorin. He can go from free and clear property. Rova Lo Amar Kerabo Barhuna. Rava's explanation of the case, which is that we're talking about a case where it's Mleya Peirot, and then he did damage to the property. He doesn't like Lo Amar Kerabo Barhuna's explanation that we're talking about Misikim, because Hari Yotza Mitachad Yado Bedino Mashma. When it says in the Braita that it's now being confiscated from him, confiscated means that it's legally confiscated. Confiscation doesn't mean that some anasim, marauders, thieves, strong men come along and take the property from you. Yeah, they do confiscate it, but that's not when you use the word confiscate. There you call stealing the property from you. That's not confiscation. Confiscation is when it's done under the auspices of the law in a legal way. And that's why he explains that the cases where Beit Din took the property away from the Gazlan and returned to the Nigzal, but there's losses here. And those losses have to be paid for by the Gazlan. Rabba bar Rav Huna lo amar kerova. Rabba Rav Huna didn't like Rava's explanation. Hare hi yotza mitachad yado be'ena mashma. When it says that the property is being confiscated from him, it sounds like the property in its original state is being confiscated from him. There's nothing mentioned in the Braita that indicates that he destroyed the property, did something to diminish the value of the property. And so therefore when he says mitachad yado, means that the way it was, that's the way it's going back. And therefore he prefers his explanation that we're talking about Mesikin over here, rather than a case that Rova came up with, which is where he destroyed the property or did damage to the property. Okay, we'll stop here, 6 lines down on the top of Ted Bava and Aleph, and tomorrow we'll discuss Ravashi's possible answer to this brighter explanation of this brighter.